Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 256, recorded for the week of April 17th, 2024, begun the custom silicon wars have. Good evening, Matt. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I am still a little under the weather coming back from Next. So we recorded last week, and then by the time I got to the weekend, I was congested and had a little bit of a cough. And then Ryan also got that. And so we've all been a little bit recovering this week, I think, from Google Next. It's a bit of a hangover, in my opinion. But other than that, it's doing great. But, you know, we are missing Ryan and Jonathan for basically the reasons I just mentioned.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it even sickness. It's post-conference sickness. Every time I go to a conference and come back after, I'm like, what happened to my immune system? Like, come on, guys.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's coupled with the fact that, you know, I was there for over a week because I celebrated my birthday the week before, and, you know, the dry air and all of the fun of that. So definitely all adds up to a rough week post Vegas every time.
Yeah, Vegas is good for 3 days, as Peter used to say.
Yeah, and like then after fish. That, it's too much. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got 2 weeks of news to catch up on from Google Next, because, you know, while Google Next was going on, the world was not stopping. And so we have several stories to touch base on that. So we're going to try to catch up here today, as well as catch us up on current news as well. But let's get into it. So first, you know, right after the cutoff for Google Next, HashiCorp issued a strongly worded cease and desist letter to the OpenTofu project, accusing the project of repeatedly taking code Hashi provided under the BSL and use it in a manner that violates those license terms and HashiCorp's intellectual property. And it notes in some instances, OpenTofu has incorrectly relabeled HashiCorp's code to make it appear as if it was made available by Hashi originally under a different license. Hashi gave them until April 10th to remove any alleged copied code from the OpenTofu repo, threatening litigation if the project failed to do so. And OpenTofu said, no, I don't think so. And we're going to have receipts to show you that you're wrong. And so they basically they denied that any BSL license code was incorporated into OpenTofu repo, and that any code they recopied came from the MPL license version of Terraform. And there's a quote, the OpenTofu team vehemently disagrees with any suggestions that it misappropriated, missourced, or misused Hashi's BSL code. All such statements have zero basis in fact. OpenTofu gave you a line-by-line comparison that showed the code that they were accused of lifting from the BSL code was actually in the MPL version and then copied into the BSL version from an older version by a Hashi engineer. And anticipating third-party contributions might submit BSL Terraform code unwittingly or otherwise, OpenTofu has instituted a taint team to compare Terraform and OpenTofu pull requests. If the PR is found to be in breach of intellectual property rights, the pull request is closed, the contributor is closed from working on that area of the code in the future. Matt SA, who we've talked about here on the show a couple times, is from Mongo, but writes for InfoWorld, dropped a hit piece when the cease and desist letter went outside, has now issued a retraction of his opinion after reviewing the documents from the OpenTofu and said they had did nothing wrong. So if you get Mongo guy to even say you did nothing wrong, that's a pretty bad, pretty good retraction on that. And it's past April 10th now, and no lawsuit has been filed that I'm aware of. So I think the OpenTofu project's in the clear.
Yeah, I mean, they did their due diligence and literally went, you know, the screenshot in the article shows you removed, you know, and goes through everything to kind of really prove it out in such a way that, like, there's no way I feel like the HashiCorp can really deny that at this point.
Agreed. So glad to see this one got resolved and we didn't waste 2 episodes talking about it because it's just silly.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, general common ideas of where Terraform should go are going to be coming on both of these platforms. And like when you copy it, or if like this is a good feature that HashiCorp released and OpenTofu wants that feature, like you can't just pull the code. Do you rewrite it from scratch? Like,
you have to.
Right. So then you rewrite it from scratch, but it does the same thing. So you're kind of in that gray area now of like you're writing the same logic. It's going to look kind of the same.
Well, and it goes the other way, too, because there may be things that OpenTofu does that, you know, because the larger Terraform community supporting OpenTofu actually ends up forcing Terraform to have to adopt some of those BSL pieces as well to be able to provide the same functionality and compatibility with OpenTofu. So we'll see, you know, how this continues to tread, you know, through the process. But, you know, there's going to be a thing about, are you OpenTofu compatible or are you Hashi compatible? It's going to have to be a question you have to start thinking about.
Mm-hmm. I feel like with, like, Elasticsearch and OpenSearch, like those kind of forked. And I didn't really hear much about this, but this is such a widely used, like, for enterprises of all sizes that, you know, I think you're going to start to see this on both sides. And this will be an interesting, you know, story of how this goes in the long term to really see where the world ends up when it comes to things like this.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have seen some, you know, fork in that road for OpenSearch and Elasticsearch. You know, they have gone different directions. They have different priorities of things they care about. Right. I actually prefer what OpenSearch is doing just because they're focusing more on scalability, reliability, making the thing actually function properly in a cloud environment versus Elasticsearch, who's chasing the AI bubble bandwagon, trying to make Vertex search and all kinds of other things function for them so they can become a big part of AI. So in this particular instance, I'm actually kind of happy with where OpenSearch is kind of focused, mm-hmm. because one of the big challenges with Elasticsearch is dealing with index management, dealing with rebalancing, dealing with shard management, and that stuff's all being kind of addressed in the OpenSearch community first, which is nice.
You just, I'll speak for Jonathan and Ryan here from their past lives. God, I don't want to see Elasticsearch ever again.
Exactly. Well, when HashiCorp is not making false allegations against OpenTofu, they are releasing potentially good features for Vault Enterprise. In the latest Vault Enterprise 1.16, they've released the new Secrets Sync feature that helps you manage secret sprawl by centralizing governance and control secrets that are stored within other secret managers. Hashi claims that secret management doesn't live up to its full potential unless it's centralized and managed on one platform. The Secret Sync lets users manage their multiple external secret managers, which are called destinations in Vault, supporting AWS Secrets Manager, Google Cloud Secrets, Microsoft Azure Key Vault, GitHub Actions, Vercel. Engineering and security teams can generate, update, delete, rotate, and revoke secrets from Vault's user interface, API, or CLI, and have those changes synced to and from external secret managers to be used by your cloud hosting applications. So I watch a lot of videos on this. I read a bunch of the documentation because I think this is really cool. It doesn't quite sync back from the cloud providers back to Vault yet. You can't create a secret in the cloud provider and have it go back to Vault. But they do have that as an alpha feature that they're testing right now. It looks like with Google, where they'll be able to pull a secret out of Google and put it into the Vault itself. But you know, being able to create it and manage it inside of Vault and then push it out to the cloud providers is still a huge benefit and a big win. And I really like to see this.
Yeah, no, this is great because especially if you are, you know, multi-cloud, you know, you can still have your centralized repository and then push out to wherever your workloads are running, or if you're running the same workload multiple places, you'd still have it be operational versus now I have to do it here and here and here. So the centralized management is great.
I mean, it also basically solves one of the big challenges if you are multi-cloud, because you'd have to set up Vault and replicate your mm-hmm. vaults between all these different cloud providers. So you'd have them local and high, mm-hmm. low latency to your app. Now, by just leveraging you're basically leveraging the cloud provider as a caching layer for your vault, and that can be, you can choose whatever cloud you want to put it into, and that can be your primary location for it, which is really handy.
Yeah, because I had definitely had a deployment where it was set up to be multi-cloud across the VPN tunnel between the two clouds. And essentially, there was a couple of vault endpoints in each location, and it was a really complicated setup, but I mean, it worked, but it was a little bit more fragile. Here, you're reliant on the cloud providers, and like you said, it's your caching layer. Great, you shove it in there. And the interesting piece about this is, I wonder if this could actually negatively affect Vault's fail, because we needed a lot of nodes in that case, and I think that caused you to have a higher price point. I don't remember all the pricing of this, but now in theory you could use less nodes because you have a caching layer.
I thought they had moved to a per security token pricing model, anyways. So I think
did they? This was a few years ago, so
yeah. So I think they changed their model to be, it's either based on users now, or it's based on number of secrets you're storing, something that isn't node based, basically.
That makes more sense.
Yeah, yeah. I look forward to seeing this one continue to develop. I'll keep an eye on it. Like I said, I was reading through the docs feverishly because I was really curious about it and how they were pulling it back, and then it was like, well, there's no mention of pulling it back, and none of the videos show it pulling it back, and then looking at the API, I'm like, oh, it's not there. Then there was a little alpha section that said, you know, sync from cloud, and it's, you know, mentions GCP is the only one provided. I'm like, they're in the early stages of syncing it back. So, but you know, One Direction is a good place to start.
Yeah, I mean, that starts to get complicated because you need triggers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So like pushing it out is a lot easier, you know, yep. And if you're going to use Event Hub or any event-based technology to do that, you know, you have to make sure it works, and authentication and all that good stuff gets complicated, you know, across the board. So I get why that's not a...
Ideally, you're going to want it, though, because if you're going to have managed keys inside of a cloud that are, you know, for RDS, for example, and they're going to rotate those keys regularly, you're going to want to be able to have those keys be available potentially to another cloud to connect to that database. So you're going to definitely want to have it at some point. And they can kind of become the glue for all of that, which is really nice once they build out the full feature set. So like I said, this is compelling to me for an enterprise feature that an open source customer probably doesn't need.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, like you said, alpha makes sense. You know, this is good. It gets out the door. It starts to get their monetary value on the product and the feature. And as they can, you know, do the AWS model of MVP, you know, and really then start to build the features out more.
Yep. Well, while Google was on stage talking about the new Axion custom silicon chip, Intel made a bunch of announcements at their conference, Vision 2024, including deep dive details on its new Gaudi 3 AI processors, which they claim offer up to 1.7 times training performance, 50% better inference, and 4% better efficiency than NVIDIA's market-leading H100 processors for significantly less money. Intel also announced that its data center CPU portfolio has a new name with the new Granite Rapids and Sierra Forest chips now branded Xeon 6, as well as they're working on a new AI NIC ASIC for the Ultra Ethernet Consortium compliant networking and an AI NIC chiplet that will be used in the future XPU and Gaudi 3 processors, as well as external customers through Intel Foundry. The Intel Gaudi 3 is the third generation of the Gaudi accelerator, which is the product of their $2 billion acquisition of Habana Labs in 2019. The Gaudi accelerator will enter production and general availability in Q3 2024 for OEM systems, as well as available in the Intel Developer Cloud. It comes in two form factors, one a PCIe dual slot capability, and another being the OAM HL325L, being the common mezzanine form factor found in high-performance GPU-based systems. This accelerator has 120 gigs of HBM2E memory, providing 3.7 terabytes of bandwidth. It also has 24 200 gigabits Ethernet NICs, and the OEM module has a 900 watt TDP and is rated for 1,835 teraflops of FP8 performance. And the OEMs are deployed in groups of 8 per server node, and you can scale up to 1,024 nodes. So that's a pretty big GPU beast if you want it.
I only understood about half of those acronyms that you said there.
Sure.
To say so.
The most important thing is that if you compare the H100 versus the Intel Gaudi, it was 1.7 times faster to train the Llama 2 13B model from Meta, and 1.4 times faster with the GPT-3 175B model, taking the same basic training operations that the H100 did. So it's a pretty performant chip for their third crack at it. And if it's cheaper and uses less power, it's a big win.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking with a person at my day job who does some ML, and he was telling me how there was a statistic out there that when they get to GPT-7, like if you, you know, assume the same growth rate across, you know, every step up of, you know, base of data that they're doing it on, it'd be 10% of the world's power based on the current ones they would consume. So if we're going to just keep improving a lot of these LLMs and make them be have more data that they're building it on and not just, you know, and optimize in other ways, we got to start to make these things be more efficient.
Agreed. Otherwise, everyone's going to be melting down power plants to try to get the power for all these GPUs.
That's later on in the podcast.
That's true.
Yeah.
Let's move on to AWS. So while Google Next was going on, Andy Jassy's annual letter to shareholders was dropped. Revenue for 2023 grew 12% year over year. There's a bunch of stuff in the letter about the store, delivery speeds, price, and advertising. But on cloud, on AWS, the only thing I really cared about, they said they started seeing substantial cost optimization inside companies trying to save money in an uncertain economy. Much of this optimization was catalyzed by AWS helping customers use the cloud more efficiently and leverage more powerful price performance AWS capabilities like Graviton chips, S3 intelligent tiering, and savings plans. This had a direct impact on short-term revenue, but was best for customers and was appreciated and should bode well for customers in AWS long-term. And by the end of the year, they say cost optimization started to attenuate and new deals accelerating and customers renewing at larger commitments over longer periods of time and migration starting to grow again. So they saw a bit of a gap, but saying overall it's coming along quite nicely. Yeah, he recapped a bunch of announcements and a strong mention of the power of Gen AI and Q, as well as customer excitement for their AI capabilities and Q in their workplaces. He goes on a long, long spiel about building primitives and how primitives are important to delivering speed, but also requires patience. Overall, people were not super jazzed with some of the things he didn't talk about in the letter. He didn't mention anything about the antitrust lawsuit from the U.S. government. He didn't talk about any of the new legislation in Europe and how it's impacting Amazon and other tech companies. He also highlighted his strong customer focus, but then the information pointed out how they have basically sued by Prime video subscribers for adding ads into paid subscriptions.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, you know, all the AI stuff was bound to be in there. If it wasn't, the world would have froze over at least three times, you know, by missing that fact. But it doesn't surprise me that, you know, the cloud providers, you know, even, you know, my day job and past day jobs, you know, where the cloud providers, while everyone thinks they want you just to make money and, you know, spend more and more and leave useless stuff out there, they really do want you to leverage it in an effective way, because otherwise you're just going to leave. So I think that with the uncertain economy, this was more and more on people's minds about cost savings and optimizations and everything. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, they knocked out the easy thing. Intelligent tiering and savings plans is relatively simple to implement, both of those. Savings plans is a few clicks of the console. Intelligent tiering, you know, could cost you a little bit of money up front, but saves you lots of money later on. So it doesn't surprise me that these are things that they push, you know, in this economy. But I do agree that in the long run, you know, you build that relationship with your customer more of, and it isn't just, hey, give us all your money. It's, we're actually here with you. And it gives that, you know, I don't want to say illusion, but that perception that everyone is, that Amazon or your cloud provider is in it with you together. And that it's more of a partnership than, you know, just a thing that you're using.
Agreed. Well, I overall found the letter to be a bit boring. So, you know, he's a good operator of the company, but I'm not necessarily sure he seems more of a Steve Ballmer than a, you know, future leader of Amazon long term. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe Andy is doing a lot more than we see, but maybe get a ghostwriter for the letter.
The problem is that probably was a ghostwriter.
Probably. It could be.
Followed by many edits of corporate, you know, legal departments and
yeah, or it was a, you know, wrote by committee kind of thing too.
Yeah.
All right. They also announced new EC2 G6 instances powered by the NVIDIA L4 Tensor Core GPU. The G6 instances can be used for a wide range of graphics intensive and machine learning use cases. G6 instances deliver up to 2x performance for learning inference and graphic workloads compared to Amazon EC2 G4 DN instances. Customers can use G6 instances for deploying ML models for natural language processing, language translation, video and image analysis, speech recognition, and personalization, as well as graphics workloads. So, always like to see a good new instance type out there.
Maybe it's just because I know them better, but every time I see the Amazon instances, I'm like, I know exactly what it is because I know the acronyms. And I don't know any of the other cloud providers. So I'm like, what is this letters? You know, even, you know, where I deal with Azure every day, I'm like, yeah, I want something cheap like a T2. Even though I'm sure it's what, T4 or T5 now at this point. So
yep.
I think it just proves I've been on AWS too long, where I'm like, just give me a T2 Nano. It's great. It's all I need. Just don't run Windows on it.
I think it's still the T3 series.
No, there's definitely T4s.
Are there T4s now? I'm looking too.
I still go to ec2instances.info, even though...
Oh, yeah, T4G, T4Is.
So. Yeah. There's no T5s yet. That will probably be later this year.
Yeah,
I feel like they went from T2s were around forever, and I feel like it went to T3s weren't around for that long, and they like kind of jumped to the T4s. But the T4s really is just the Graviton version of the T3s.
Agreed.
Do you know what's more old school than blowing on a Nintendo cartridge to make it work? Manually creating individual policies to achieve least privilege in your cloud. Leave old habits in the past, and with a single click, lock down access to sensitive permissions and services without disrupting DevOps. With the new Cloud Permissions Firewall from Sunry Security, you can easily restrict excessive permissions from human and machine identities, quarantine unused identities, and restrict specific regions and unused services with a click of a button. Start a 14-day free trial for Sunry's Cloud Permissions Firewall at sunry.co/cloudpod. That's SONRAI.co/cloudpod.
Well, Amazon KMS is announcing new options for automatic key rotations. You can now customize the frequency of a rotation period between 90 days to 7 years, as well as invoke key rotation on demand for customer managed KMS keys. And lastly, you can now see the history of all previous rotations for any KMS key that has been rotated. They're also introducing new pricing for KMS automatic key rotation. Previously, each rotation would cost you $1 per month per rotation to a KMS customer managed key. And now KMS keys can be rotated automatically or on demand. The first and second rotation of a key adds $1 a month. This price increase is capped at the second rotation, and all rotations after your second rotation are not billed. For customers that have keys with three or more rotations, all of the keys will see a price reduction to $3 a month starting the first week of May 2024.
I just always use this feature and just check the box that said key rotation and never looked at it again. Yeah. And never thought about it again. So I'll be like, if it automatically rotates and it doesn't affect my product, it doesn't affect it running, why do I want it to last for longer? And the only, or shorter, like, I don't know what it was before because it just did it for me. But I guess maybe if you're encrypting your data, like with a KMS key versus I just used it more like, hey, leverage this key to encrypt my data, like on the cloud, more like data at rest than data, and, you know, but sounds great. Thank you. I don't know where I'll use this.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of just, you know, automatic key rotation, but I mean, there are times when you need to do a manual invocation if, you know, a key potentially had access to an employee and you have proof that the employee downloaded the key, et cetera, you might need to do it. Well, last month, Amazon told us all about Mistral AI models, Mistral 7B and Mistral 8X7B, such sexy names, just roll off the tongue, available to you on Bedrock. And now they're also bringing Mistral Large to Bedrock. Mistral Large is ideal for complex tasks that require substantial reasoning capabilities or ones that are highly specialized, such as synthetic text generation or code generation. They also wanted to mention at the Paris Summit, they also released Bedrock to the Paris region. So if you were looking to get your French AI on, you can now do that with Bedrock in France.
I'm speechless. I'm so excited.
I'm glad you stunned. Stunned, I hear you.
Yeah, that's all I got for you. It's great.
It's fine. So we've talked about it here on the show, and I've talked about it at several conferences where in topic and, you know, Q&A sessions where people talk about, what do you worry about with the cloud? I've mentioned EU power is a big problem. And this is the first article I've seen where basically a first time a major cloud provider has sort of publicly acknowledged the power issue. Amazon is apparently restricting resources users can spin up in the Ireland region and directing customers to other AWS regions across Europe instead. Energy consumed by the DC is a growing concern, and you cannot spin up those GPU nodes in AWS Dublin as those locations are maxed out power-wise. When Amazon was pushed for a statement, they responded, Ireland remains core to our global industry strategy and will continue to work with customers to understand their needs and help them to scale and grow their business. The grid operator in Ireland, Air Grid, estimates the data center power draw will reach 25.7% of the national energy consumption by 2026. So power-hungry data centers, going back to your comment about how AI needs to really figure a way to get more cost-efficient and more power-efficient before it gets really wide adoption is so true.
Yeah, I mean, 25% of a whole country's power is a lot. And this is one of their oldest regions. So I feel like I think we looked this up at one time on the show in real time, and this was like one of the first, you know, European regions. So it doesn't surprise me that it's a little bit, just foreshadowing a little bit, like US East 1, or maybe not like US East 1 anymore, depends how you feel, where it's probably a little bit more resource constrained and whatnot, where, you know, some of the other ones that were probably built with higher specifications, as, you know, 10 years later, they had a better idea what the clouds were doing than when they first built it out for the first time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, considering how long these, you know, these data centers have been around and how many of them are, I mean, like in Amazon's US East region, for example, there's hundreds of complexes now that have been built to support that region. So the, you know, imagine Ireland is probably being one of the larger EU regions, probably also multiple buildings, multiple power hungry operations that have to be powered and fed all the time.
And it's not a very big country. So, you know, they got to get power from somewhere.
Just get it from the Brits. It's fine.
Yeah, they don't have any problems.
They have no problems there. Yeah.
No issues. Don't just wait for it to 35 Celsius. No problems.
Yeah, no issues. Yeah. Heat waves are going to be a problem for them in the summer, perhaps, power wise. So that'll be interesting. Well, the Claude's Opus has finally come to Bedrock. Opus is the intelligent Claude 3 model with the best-in-market performance on highly complex tasks. You can navigate open-ended prompts and sign unseen scenarios with remarkable fluency and human-like understanding, leading the frontier of general intelligence. So that means you now have Haiku, Opus, and whatever the third one is, I can't remember the name of, all now available on Bedrock.
Now all I can think of is, I'm trying to remember what it was.
It's a Haiku... There's another one. I don't remember what it is. No one needs those anyways. Opus, great. Sonnet, and Haiku.
Sonnet, that's what it was.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's great. They're just going to keep adding it. And, you know, I really like the ability to just select which one you want. You know, and that, you know, it's great that everyone's adding all these. And I feel like we're at that point, like we talked a couple of weeks ago, about we're getting these wide availabilities and wide options of things that you're going to have. And you're going to have to start to select these right models and figure out which ones work better for your specific workloads. So good luck with the new challenge in life.
I do look forward to, you know, tooling coming out to help you figure out which model is the best for your workload, and help you kind of figure that out, because otherwise it's, you know, a lot of cost, a lot of expense trying to work out which models are the best ones for you, and lots of test runs. Well, the next announcement is something that I really love. I love these type of tools. So the internet is a crazy place of BGP routes, dark fiber, undersea cables, overland cables, governments, wars, politics, Russian submarines cutting cables, all kinds of things that are out of your control. And when something on the internet goes bump in the night, it affects your customers or sites, and you would want to be able to quickly localize and understand the issue as quickly as possible. You know, is your customer complaining because you're down or because one of their carriers is down? Amazon CloudWatch is pleased to introduce the Internet Weather Map to help. Built atop a collection of global monitors operated by AWS, you get a broad global view of internet weather with the ability to zoom in and understand performance and availability issues that affect a particular city or region. While these types of things exist on the internet, I like this one. It's managed by CloudWatch. Amazon is considering adding additional features to this, not just a one-time thing, and wants feedback, but some of the ideas they're thinking about are displaying causes of certain types of outages, such as DDoS, BGP route leaks, and issues with route interconnects, or adding a view that is specific to chosen ISPs and displaying the impact to public SaaS companies as well, which I think is a great additional step on that.
All I can think of is the reason is, you know, the internet seeking backhoe, the fiber seeking backhoe.
Yes.
I feel like we'll have to add that to the show notes, the image of that one. But I mean, I love this. You know, it's like you said, the internet's a crazy complex place. And, you know, listening, you know, you see all these undersea cables that, you know, really power the internet. And I was recently long haul on the internet. I was reading about Bermuda's internet and, you know, the Google fiber that's going to like double their internet speed as soon as it comes, you know, and it'll be their first direct link to Europe. And it's just crazy how complex the internet is, and everyone just takes it for granted.
Yep. Yeah. So it's really nice when you go into the map view, it shows you, you know, incidents around the world. And so like right now at this moment we're recording, there's 20 incidents in Europe right now. And so if I drill into that, I can see that, you know, in Britain, British Telecom has a PLC ASN 2856, which is a route indicator that has a performance issue. And it's been having a performance issue for 19 minutes, which is really handy. If you have a customer who's having to use BT in that part of UK, this might be why they're having problems with your app. So these are very cool. You can also set up in the internet monitors, basically the endpoints that you want to monitor traffic for. And so they'll actually tell you that they're seeing, you know, one of these things impact traffic coming into your network load balancer or your load balancer, CloudFront distribution, or your VPC.
Can I use it to monitor Azure to tell me when they have another outage in Germany and takes down their whole region?
I don't know about that, but yeah, you know, sure, give it a shot. So apparently the Register has an article that... Amazon doesn't want US East 1 to have such a bad rap anymore. The headline is, US East 1 region is not the cloudy crock it's made out to be, claims AWS EC2 boss. Dave Brown is that boss. He's the global VP of compute and networking at AWS. Spoke with Register at the Sydney Summit and defended US East 1, the cloud giant's first region, which has had more than its fair share of outages. Brown argued that the region's age doesn't mean it's less resilient than any other AWS facility and spans hundreds of data centers, but it didn't elaborate further. Because the region is so big, it's a natural target for early efforts and therefore experiences early failures, which is exactly what our complaint is that it fails more often because you do more experiments there and you roll things out there first, which if they're not, you know, you miss something in QA, we get impacted more. So he's sort of counteracting his own argument in this thing. But I love the fact that they're, you know, they're aware that everyone thinks it's a tire fire and they don't like it.
Well, it's USCLO 1. That's where they do their QA testing.
Exactly. Sandbox, USC Sandbox 1.
Yeah. I mean, for how old it is, like, I remember the S3, the big S3 outage, I think it was like 2017. And when I start doing things based on years and I realize what year it is, I just die a little bit on the inside. But when they had to like reboot all of S3 and US East 1, because that was the way they had to fix it, I was like, okay, like this thing's been running for that long without like any major overhaul. So, you know, there's going to be pieces that fail in any infrastructure that is that old and handles that much workload.
Yeah. I mean, it's hundreds of data centers, probably the biggest scale of any AWS region in the world. So, you know, again, I'm not saying it's, you know, comparatively what it is, considering the number of nodes, the number of compute, the number of customers are there. Like the fact that it doesn't have more problems is a testament to Amazon's engineering. But still, if I had a choice, I'm not going to choose it as my primary region. Ohio it is, and then Oregon.
Yeah, Ohio definitely is where I go for things.
Yep. Well, moving on to GCP. If you checked out our episode last week, you heard our highlights from the show, things that we saw. And Google, as usual, dropped their all 218 things we announced at Google Cloud Next 24, a recap. Now, that's 218 things minus 10 customer case studies, 14 partner things. And so I think it's really technically 194. But, you know, it's Google. That's what they do. So I'm not going to complain too much. I did have a chance to cover a couple things in video since I was there last week and some of my downtime. There's not much of that. But when I had a free lunch hour, I watched the developer keynote, which was really good. I wish I'd seen it in person now. I'll kick myself for not doing that this year. I'll do it next year. But I was most impressed with the demo they did in that Gemini Cloud Assist. Basically, they took a load balancer that was having some type of networking access problems. And they basically use the chat assistive Gemini Cloud Assist to basically ask a bunch of questions to figure out that there was a problem with the configuration of the load balancer and also address fixing that issue in the chat message as well, all within just a few minutes of starting troubleshooting. So really powerful capability. And that Gemini Cloud Assist will give you a lot of opportunities to do other things beyond just networking. There's quite a few announcements, particularly targeting Cloud Assist. So lots of opportunity for you to learn more there. There was a couple other things I saw from the doc that we didn't talk about last week that I thought we should maybe mention real quickly. So there's a new LLM capability for spam blocking that they're rolling out. You can now set up message interoperability between Google Chat with Slack and Teams via their partner Mio. We talked about the C3 bare metal instances in addition, or sorry, we talked about the N5 and the C4 last week, but they also have a new C3 bare metal. They have a new X4 memory instance and the Z4 VMs for storage dense workloads. They have a bunch of new storage pool advanced capabilities that look pretty interesting, as well as the Google Networking Cloud Assist we talked about, and lots of new cloud load balancing features coming very soon for inference work. And the cloud service is a fully managed service mesh that combines traffic directors, control planes, and Google's open source Istio-based service mesh with Anthos service mesh. Lots of connectivity improvements for Private Service Connect, as well as inline network data loss prevention in preview, and Private Service Connect is now fully integrated into Cloud SQL. So lots of great things. Definitely check out the 218 things they mentioned. I'm sure there's something in there for you that you were looking for in the cloud.
It's amazing to me how they decide what's going to go in keynote and what's not, and what's going to get announced and all these small ones. Because some of these are pretty cool features, you know, and you know the complicatedness of just getting them up and operational is amazing. And then, you know, announcing them, and then it's just like, oh, it's just this little side announcement that, you know, very few people, unless if you listen to people like us, you know, will really find out about.
Yep. Well, and it was, you know, I'd bookmarked all the YouTube videos are up from the conference now. So I have on another browser tab, all my what's new sessions. I went and searched for all the what's new to check those out. So I'll be watching some of those next week. I did check out the partner video as well, the partner keynote. Unless you're a partner, don't bother. It's dull. There's some really cool partner things though if you are a partner, but as a layman who's not a partner trying to implement Google services, I found it to be pretty dry and not very interesting. So I would skip that if you're not a partner or in the partner ecosystem.
Good to know.
You're welcome. All right. Well, moving right along to their new cybersecurity and AI capabilities. This is partially in response to Biden's executive order on AI, but it also drives more revenue for Google. Google is releasing the new generative AI courses on YouTube and Google Cloud Skills Boost for introductory level to advanced. Once you complete the hands-on training, you can show off your new skills badge to employers from introductory, which is no cost, intermediate and advanced levels, which have a slight cost. And Google says there are over 505,000 open entry-level roles related to cloud cybersecurity analysts and 725,000 roles for cloud data analysts, which is why they are launching their new growth with Google Career Certificates for data analytics and cybersecurity. So grid training, I started taking one of them just to see what it's about. It's pretty comprehensive for an introductory course on AI. So if you have somebody who's like, I don't really understand this AI thing, it's a good little set of labs from Quick Labs on how to do that. So definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to try to check it out to learn a little bit more too.
Definitely recommend it. Moving on to Azure. So there wasn't a lot going on other than AI things, since they always like to announce, and mostly just, you know, be more effective with more AI that we want to sell you with AI with more AI. So, but this one was AI? Interesting because it's about, yeah, I know. What's the big deal about that? But this was an interesting article. Microsoft and Quantinuum demonstrated the most reliable logical qubits on record with an error rate of 800 times better than physical qubits. This is a major achievement of the quantum ecosystem. Microsoft and Quantinuum demonstrated the most reliable logical qubits on record by applying Microsoft's breakthrough qubit virtualization system with error diagnostics and correction to Quantinuum's ion trap. They ran more than 214,000 individual experiments without a single error. Furthermore, they demonstrated more reliable quantum computation by performing error diagnostics and corrections on logical qubits without destroying them. And this move is the amount of current noisy intermediate scale quantum, or NISQ level 1, to NISQ level 2. Resilient quantum computing. This is a huge accomplishment. And if you want to know more about what the error rate has to do with quantum computing, check out the Monday Live talk from reInvent, where they talked about the large challenge of quantum computing around errors and scaling due to the number of errors that happen in qubits. So this is a big breakthrough. I expect to see other providers start copying similar capabilities from this.
Yeah, I mean, this technology is such bleeding edge that, like, I barely understand what they're talking about, but I know error rates are bad and that's not good. You know, so having things be able to run longer without, you know, solid error rates are good, you know, and this is hopefully where, this is probably where the industry is going, you know, in the next 30 years. So it's interesting to kind of watch the technology grow from the ground up, which is kind of fun.
Agreed. And then Cloudflare is in the news. They had a blog post. Apparently their data center lost power again. I don't know if you remember this from November last year, but their data center basically lost power across all their circuits and the whole Cloudflare system crashed and burned in horrible, horrible pain and death. And so Cloudflare, after that issue, you know, did a great RCA, which we talked about here on the show back in December timeframe. And they initially could have a project they called Code Orange, which they borrowed from Google. So when Google has an accidental threat to their business, they declare code yellow or code red. Their color, of course, orange. So that all makes sense to me. But 5 months after the first failure, they were able to test Code Orange. Unlike November, they knew right away that they had lost power when the data center went down. They also knew after an internet cut test in February how their system would react. So at 1458 UTC, the PDX01 center lost power and their systems kicked into gear. And by 1505, which is 7 minutes, their API and dashboards were operating normally with zero human intervention. Their primary focus over the past few months has been to make sure that customers would still be able to configure and operate the Cloudflare service if any data center failed. In the November outage, 14 services were down for over 6 hours or more. And this time, all those services were up and running in minutes. Not everything was made as resilient. Services like analytics were still impacted as they had not completed their Code Orange work yet, as they're more complicated. But this is a great forward progress, and they're very pleased with what the results showed. They're not very pleased with their data center, though. They did mention maybe we shouldn't be at that facility if they keep losing power. But
Amazon's stealing all the power in Oregon, that's why.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I mean, 6 months to go from being down for many hours and having to, you know, if I remember the RCA correctly, you know, they found a bunch of apps that were, you know, kind of thrown into production from dev, you know, quickly and weren't fully set up in their quote-unquote production setup, you know, to having 6 minutes of automated downtime, you know, an automatic rollover. 6 minutes, I probably clicked the button, got distracted by a shiny object and came back to it 6 minutes later and didn't even think about that. It wasn't working. So it's amazing what they were able to get through in 6 months, you know, and I'm sure bravo to every engineer, software dev, DevOps, whoever was involved with doing all that, because that's an impressive feat.
Very impressive. So So kudos to the Cloudflare team. Nicely done. And that wraps us up. Matt, no more stories for today.
Well,
just before my voice totally loses it.
Yeah, post conference, I'm impressed you lasted this long.
I am too. Well, we'll see you next week here on the show, and have a great rest of your week.
You too. Bye, everyone.
And that's the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank this week's sponsor, Sunry. Check out a 14-day free trial at sunry.co/cloudpod. Check out our website, the home of the CloudPod, where you can check out our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet at us with hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod.